One is a policy which we would probably pursue even if there were no Soviet threat. So why was this national security strategy being constructed in relation to the Soviet Union if the Soviet threat was not the main focus of the whole basis of the policy? It's something that would have been pursued anyway. So what were the threats? Well, this was revealed by a former State Department official by the name of Richard Barnett. And he argued that the containment doctrine was more or less a framework for demonizing threats to the prevailing economic, capitalistic economic order, the function of which they considered integral to US economic security. And this is what he says. He goes, the word communist has been applied so liberally and so loosely to revolutionary or radical regimes that any government risks being so characterized if it adopts one or more of the following policies which the State Department finds distasteful. One, nationalization of private industry. Two, particularly foreign-owned corporations. Three, radical land reform. Four, autarkic trade policies. Three, acceptance of Soviet or Chinese aid. And five, four, insistence upon following an anti-American or non-aligned foreign policy, among others. And historian Joseph Stromberg, he argues that the defense against the free world, the defense of the free world against communism, became the most potent slogan veiling US imperial activities and justifying open-door intervention around the world. And one particular example of this that I'd like to just discuss briefly, because it's very instructive, is the example of Guatemala in Latin America. One State Department advisor noted that US policy in Latin America during this period, he argued that economic nationalism is the common denominator of the new aspirations for industrialization. Latin Americans are convinced that the first beneficiaries of the development of a country's resources, should be the people of that country. And ironically, a 1949 National Security Council study highlighted the problematic nature of economic nationalism for US policy. It said it urged the need to develop mechanisms for exerting economic pressures on such countries that refuse to be subjected to the role of supplying strategic commodities and other basic materials to the United States and the West. Now, this phenomenon of economic nationalism in Latin America was therefore seen as a basic threat to national security. It is in this context that in 1954, a State Department official argued that Guatemala has become an increasing threat to the stability of Honduras and El Salvador. And you'll love this. This is what he says. He goes, its agrarian reform is a powerful propaganda weapon. Its broad social program of aiding workers and peasants in the victorious struggle against the upper classes and large foreign enterprises has a strong appeal to the populations of Central American neighbors where similar conditions prevail. Now, the Guatemalan government, which was run then by Jacob Arbenz, was actively implementing this program of agrarian reform. It was designed to redistribute hundreds of thousands of acres to previously landless peasants. And this conflicted with U.S. economic interests or corporate interests. For instance, the holdings of the U.S.-based United Fruit Company, that was the largest landowner in the entire country, concentrating on the production of bananas for export. And because of this agrarian reform program, United Fruit's holdings were significantly threatened. So in response to this threat, the United States government and private companies exercised pressure to maintain the country's archaic and unjust socioeconomic structures. And this was followed ultimately, as we all know, by the US-backed coup in 1954, which overthrew the democratic government and installed a brutal dictatorship. Now notably, the Soviet Union was a negligible factor in Guatemalan affairs, having neither established any kind of diplomatic mission in the country, nor having provided any military aid there. And the Communist Labour Party in Guatemala was the smallest one in Arbenz's coalition government. It held only 4 seats amongst a total of 51. But this was the earliest US intervention in Latin America justified as a response to Soviet expansionism. Now, interestingly, George Kennan, who was the architect of the containment doctrine, he himself subsequently discounted the reality of this overarching Soviet threat. He said, the image of a Stalinist Russia poised and yearning to attack the West and deterred only by possession of atomic weapons was largely a creation of Western imagination. And declassified documents that have come out of the British Foreign Office actually confirm this. And I'll quote very briefly a few for you here. There's one from 1950. Which says that only 3 Middle Eastern countries are exposed to direct Soviet attack. And then it goes on to illustrate that all of those countries, any such attack is completely inconceivable. It says, short of general war, an attack on Turkey is unlikely owing to the Western guarantees that she enjoys. As for Iran, the Soviet government must be aware that any attack on her would carry a grave risk of general war, and it's more likely that Soviet efforts to gain control of Iran will be confined to propaganda. Regarding Afghanistan, it says there is little danger of attack. In the Arab states in general, in one document says the Arab states are all orientated towards the West in varying degrees, opposed to communism, and generally successful at present in minimizing or suppressing existing communist activities. So what was the problem in the Arab states? It says, rather, ultra-nationalist elements may exercise greater influence and form a greater threat to the maintenance of a pro-Western orientation. In Africa, the State Department observes during 1950 that black Africa is orientated towards the non-communist world. Communism has made no real progress in this area, but, to the contrary, the State Department says nationalism constitutes the real force of the future in this area. In Asia, Kennan, head of the US policy planning staff at that time, he affirmed that the problem isn't one primarily of Russians, but of basic relations of Americans with Asiatics. And in 1950, the State Department reiterated that in most of Southeast Asia, there is no fear of communism as we know it. So what was the problem? We find that nationalism is the consistent theme that is considered a threat. And in 1952, a British Foreign Office study described this very candidly. They said, the problem is nationalism, and it consists of five key components. Insistence on managing their own affairs without the means or ability to do so, including the dismissal of the British advisers. Expropriation of British assets. Unilateral denunciation of treaties with the UK, and this may bring back memories of the Iraq War, ganging up against the UK and the Western powers in the United Nations. So all this is completely at odds with the tone and substance of US and British and Western national security discourse throughout the Cold War period. Contrary to the conventional security discourse and scholarship, this data suggests that there was negligible Soviet or communist threat to most of the world. This doesn't mean that the Soviet Union didn't pose any sort of potential threat, explaining the dynamics of the bipolar system. But countering or repelling Soviet expansionism was obviously not the central galvanizing factor in the formulation of Western national security strategy. On the contrary, the bipolar system was a convenient framework for both superpowers to command and mobilize domestic politics and resources in the service of powerful vested interests. So the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, and with it the collapse of the bipolar system, didn't actually alter the fundamental dynamic of US national security strategy and Western foreign policy. On the contrary, it granted a completely new lease of life to this policy. So in 1990, we find Senator William Cohen of the Armed Services Committee, who later became Clinton's Secretary of Defense, he emphasized that despite the end of the Cold War, there remained a need to, quote, project power into other regions and maintain access to distant markets and resources. What does this mean? Well, the meaning of this was discussed in more detail in the same year by Marine Corps Commandant General A.M. Gray, writing in the Marine Corps Gazette. And he argued that, in fact, the majority of the crises we have responded to since the end of World War II have not directly involved the Soviet Union. Very, very candid admission there. Then he says, as with most with US interventions during the Cold War, quote, the underdeveloped world's growing dissatisfaction over the gap between rich and poor nations will create fertile breeding ground for insurgencies. These insurgencies have the potential to jeopardize regional stability and our access to vital economic and military resources. This situation will become more critical as our nation and its allies become more and more dependent on these resources. If we are to have stability in these regions, maintain access to their resources, defend our vital installations, and deter conflict, we must maintain within our active force structure a credible military power projection capable with the flexibility to respond across the spectrum of violence throughout the globe. So the ultimate aim of maintaining military credibility in the next century is, according to Gray, continued unimpeded access to, quote, developing economic markets throughout the world and to the resources needed to support our manufacturing requirements. So the bipolar system had acted more as a constraining force on the imperial trajectory of US power projection. Its collapse only entailed the elimination of this constraint, permitting US policymakers to pursue the expansion and consolidation of US global political and economic power. But this was also a problem, because with the collapse of the bipolar system, the national security system was devoid of any viable external threat to justify post-Cold War US imperial expansion. So new national security frameworks were needed they had needed to be constructed in which new categories of enemy could be situated. So successive US administrations in the aftermath of the Cold War, they began working incessantly on new threats and pretexts with which to replace the dead threat of communism. And several spectres of doom came to the fore. Rogue states, weapons of mass destruction, and most dangerous of all, Islamic terror. So we have someone like Leon T. Hader, who used to be with the Jerusalem Post, arguing that now that the Cold War has become a memory, America's foreign policy establishment has begun searching for new enemies. Possible new villains include instability in Europe, which is a pretext for going into the Balkans. Potential new global bogeymen, however, are the yellow peril, the alleged threat to economic security emanating from East Asia, and the so-called green peril, green being the color of Islam. That peril is symbolized by the Middle Eastern Muslim fundamentalist, the Fundi, to use a term coined by The Economist. And in 1995, NATO Secretary General Willie Claes described Islam as at least as dangerous as communism was. He added that NATO is much more than a military alliance. It has committed itself to defending basic principles of civilization that bind North American and Western Europe. So that, of course, brings us to the controversial clash of civilizations thesis put forward by someone like Samuel Huntington, which projects the probability of this future cataclysmic war between Western civilization and Islamic civilization. Now, Tim Haymes, the leading guy in the Republican Party, who's very close to Bush in the Bush administration, he claimed one day after the 9/11 attacks that Huntington's thesis was dominating the US political scene. And it's pretty clear then that Al-Qaeda falls very conveniently into this framework. And that we have, there's a quote from an article published in the US Army War College Journal called Parameters, which describes what the Bush Doctrine implies with regards to this threat of Al-Qaeda. And it describes the threat as an imminent, multifaceted, undeterrable, and potentially calamitous threat to the United States. A threat that by virtue of the combination of its destructiveness and invulnerability has no precedent in American history. By implication, such a threat demands an unprecedented response. And that explains the nature of the Bush Doctrine. Because the Bush Doctrine, in response to this apocalyptic infinite enemy, basically puts forward a program of unlimited, unilateral, offensive, or preemptive wars. And the scope and depth of the political threats encompassed by the Bush Doctrine, it extends over to the whole world, which is exactly the target of imperial conquest. So the Bush Doctrine, if we analyze that in more detail, it highlights specifically the importance of vague plans and emerging threats rather than identifying specific state-like targets or anything like that. And in other words, because of this, the targets of national security discourse are open to ambiguity. Anything can be defined as a threat. And there's one guy by the name of John Eikenberry. He's a professor of geopolitics at George Washington University. And he argues that the Bush Doctrine basically forms a neo-imperial vision. The United States has arrogated itself the global role of setting standards, determining threats, and using force to mete out justice. It's a vision in which sovereignty becomes more absolute for the United States and the West, even as it becomes more conditional for countries that challenge Washington's standards of internal and external behavior. Now, supporting this interpretation of the Bush Doctrine is the fact that underlying the new national security strategy is a wide array of long-term planning, geostrategic and geoeconomic in nature, for the global expansion of US economic influence. The new national security strategy provides a discourse that legitimizes an imperial grand strategy as a war on terror. Now, the fundamentally imperial nature of this war on terror, launched in the aftermath of 9/11, was articulated a year before the attacks in the blueprint, which is absolutely notorious and you all know about it, published by the Project for the New American Century. And as we know, the Project for the New American Century is wired into the Bush administration. Now, the plan outlined in this document is worth going into because it represents the essential sentiments of the Bush cabinet before they came into power. It supports, quote, a blueprint for maintaining global U.S. preeminence, precluding the rise of a great power rival, shaping the international security order in line with American principles and interests. It says that U.S. armed forces operating abroad are the cavalry on the new American frontier. A core mission of this cavalry is to fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars. To thus preserve what the report describes as a global Pax Americana, the report concludes that U.S. forces must perform constabulary duties. In other words, they have to function as a global police force. Peacekeeping missions demand American political leadership rather than that of the United Nations. Instead of the UN, and this is not very good for us in the UK, the UK is pinpointed as a convenient US instrument. It says that the most effective and efficient means of exercising American global leadership is the British government. And I think that maybe has something to do with Blair. But it says that this has to secure this plan and to prevent any state from challenging this plan, a larger US military presence has to be spread around the globe. This is in addition, we have to remember, to the 130 nations where US forces are already stationed. And that means establishing more military bases in the Middle East, in Southeast Europe, in Latin America, and in Southeast Asia, where no bases previously existed. Even further, the report endorses the creation of US space forces to dominate space, as well as absolute control of cyberspace to counter enemies attempting to use the internet to thwart US interests, which probably could be anybody who checks their email and says something bad about Bush. The blueprint also shows that Bush's cabinet had planned to establish military control over the Persian Gulf, regardless of Saddam Hussein and any military threat that his regime may or may not have posed. It says, the United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. But Iraq is only the beginning. Among the other pertinent points raised in this document is the fact that even should Saddam pass from the scene, the US intends to maintain bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait permanently, despite domestic opposition. It further lists the same states publicly fingered by President Bush after 9/11 as constituting the core axis of evil: North Korea, Syria, Libya, Iran. It says that the US should respond to the threat posed by these regimes by establishing a worldwide command and control system, a polite euphemism for a global police state. Iran in particular, it says, may well prove a larger threat to US interests. The document advocates regime change in China, supported by increasing, it says, the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia, in order that American and allied power provide the spur to the process of democratization in China. And Europe is also mentioned as a potential rival. So perhaps the most disturbing element of this document is this recognition that it couldn't be implemented without the United States suffering some sort of sudden, unprecedented crisis. And remember that this document was published in September 2000. One paragraph in the document says, any serious effort at transformation must occur within the larger framework of US national security strategy. But further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one without some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. Now, these sentiments echo the analysis of the arch geostrategist Brzezinski, who was former national security advisor to President Carter. And in his book, The Grand Chessboard, published by the CFR in 1997, he said, for America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia. Now a non-Eurasian power is preeminent in Eurasia, and America's global primacy is directly dependent on how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained. To put it in a terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. And this is the key point that he says. As America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. He also says elsewhere in the same book that the attitude of the American public towards the external projection of American power has been much more ambivalent. The public supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. So in hindsight, both the Project for the New American Century Blueprint and the Brzezinski analysis articulate the instrumental role that 9/11 played in terms of mobilizing public support for a new imperial geostrategy. And once again, the designated security threat is not central to the actual strategy itself. On the contrary, it's entirely peripheral. It plays only the role of this ideological construction that is useful for legitimizing this strategy. The strategy is primary. The security threat that strategy is supposed to be directed against is secondary and based only on the basis of imperial requirements. And this gives us a very interesting insight into the into the purpose that national security discourse plays today. It is ultimately the discourse of empire, and it allows the United States and the Western world to remain on a footing of permanent war. Just to give you some brief examples of how this imperial geostrategy has escalated terror while repressing freedom in the aftermath of 9/11. If we look around the world, let's take, for example, what happened in Afghanistan. According to Mark Herold, who's a professor at the University of New Hampshire, as you know, as I mentioned in the War on Freedom, over 3,000 Afghan civilians were killed in the war in Afghanistan. And subsequently as well, there have been many reports quoting US Special Forces who are fighting on the ground in Afghanistan. There was one quote by a Special Forces soldier by the name of Matthew Guckenheimer. He was quoted in the Ithaca Journal, and he was saying that when they were on the ground, they were looking for Al-Qaeda terrorists. He said, "We also encountered many men, women, and children, and we killed them all because they were all enemy, and many of them were combatants, even the children." In other words, this is an indiscriminate war, and a very key element of the strategy is targeting civilians. If we extend this analysis and look at what's been happening in Iraq, for example, Iraq began by using this operational war plan called Shock and Awe. You probably heard about that. Now, that operational war plan was published in 1996 by the National Defense University, which is funded by the Pentagon. And it basically outlines a new way of war for the United States. It says that rather than targeting the enemy's military forces, you have to use such a degree of overwhelming military force that you don't have to destroy the enemy's forces. The impact is going to be so huge that the enemy will simply surrender. And it compares the impact of this new way of war to the impact of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with the use of conventional weapons. And so what happens when you analyze the conduct of the war, what they did, they immediately shut off the power and water supplies to key Iraqi cities. Subsequently, there was this massive onslaught they fired thousands and thousands of cruise missiles within a few days more than they had fired within the entire first 1991 Gulf War. And this devastated the infrastructure. In the first Gulf War, it's now been known that 3,000 Iraqi civilians were killed. And subsequent to that, as a result of the devastation of the infrastructure, another 100,000 Iraqis died. So the overall death toll was about 100,000 plus the 3,000. Now, today, the latest surveys prove that the number of Iraqi civilians that have died in this war amounts to 10,000. So if you just calculate what the ratio of this will be, that's 10,000 times 10,000 and 3,000. The ratio is about 3 to 1. So if you multiply by 3, but in order to calculate in order to project the future civilian deaths as a result of the damage to the infrastructure, we're talking about 500,000 Iraqi deaths in the coming years as an overall result of this policy. And this has been accompanied in Iraq by this attempt to consolidate the US occupation by co-opting the very Ba'athist regime that we were supposed to be removing. Saddam Hussein is gone, and his immediate entourage is gone. But many reports in the British press and also in the American press has proven that very key elements of the Ba'athist establishment involved in war crimes and genocide against the Iraqi people are now being put back in key positions in the Iraqi administration because they switched sides at the right time. And of course, if we want to project this further and look at how the US policy is going on elsewhere, the United States government has managed to push itself into Central Asia. They've managed to co-opt many of the Central Asian republics, and they're trying to sideline Russian and European involvement in those regions. If we look at Latin America, we have the latest intervention in Haiti. Everyone wonders why on earth are they going in Haiti? There's nothing there. Well, Haiti is on the border of Venezuela, and Venezuela is a key oil producer. And as we know, Hugo Chavez is somebody who is not very friendly to the United States and not very friendly to U.S. interests in the region. And Haiti, the movement into Haiti looks like another movement of forces in order to prepare for what could be a future military intervention. And if we look at the geographical movement of U.S. forces around the globe, in all these strategic regions, the U.S. military is going into places where energy resources are key and making sure that it dominates them to the exclusion of its allies. And the impetus for this as you must have heard from Michael Rupert, as you'll be hearing later on from Michael Rupert and Richard Heinberg, is the issue of peak oil. And I'm going to leave it at that because they'll be talking about that soon, and I hope you stay and listen to that. And I'll basically end by saying that whenever you hear someone talk about national security, remember that national security traditionally throughout the post-war period has always been used as a front to justify imperialism and to increase and escalate terror abroad. National security is not about our security. It's decreasing our security. It's decreasing the security of the people around the world. Instead, it's increasing the security of corporate elites who are only concerned about maximizing their power and profit. And we have to do what we can to investigate this process and what role 9/11 played in galvanizing public opinion to support this process. Thanks.
For more information on the work of Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed, visit on the web www.globalresearch.org. Globalresearch.org. Next, we'll hear the soundtrack of a video documentary featuring Michelle Chesedovsky, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa and the author of The Globalization of Poverty. The film is introduced by his colleague, Ian Woods.
Hello, everyone. Professor Michelle Chesedovsky is my partner in cause, as we say, and he is the co-editor of Global Outlook magazine, which you'll find upstairs. He's also the brains behind the website, globalresearch.ca. If you haven't been there, it's one of the best websites on 9/11 and the war agenda. And he is also the author of Globalization of Poverty, which some of you may have read. This has been published in 11 languages and sold over 100,000 copies. And we have copies upstairs for sale as well. And he is also the author of the best-selling War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September the 11th, which has sold about 7,000 copies, and that is available upstairs as well. Tonight, we're going to see a clip from the companion video to the book called War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September the 11th. It's a short 20-minute clip from an interview taken by Snowshoe Films. And thank you, Snowshoe. They're out there somewhere filming all of this. And hopefully we're going to be able to get footage of all of the conference later on, thanks to Snowshoe. It's called Disarming the War Agenda. And Michelle will be talking about the broader aspects of the hidden agenda. And without further ado, I will ask if they can roll the film. Thank you.
It's not an issue of a narrow group of advisors, the so-called neocons in the Pentagon and the State Department. It's a much broader process where particular groups of officials may come to rotate from one administration to the next, so as to ensure the U.S. Agenda of sequential theater wars, which is outlined in the PNAC. Ample evidence to suggest that the Bush administration, senior officials within the Bush administration, were involved in acts of complicity and camouflage with regard to the events of 9/11. And this is not simply a question of foreknowledge. It's the fact that the CIA has supported Al-Qaeda, that Al-Qaeda is an intelligence asset, that Al-Qaeda has performed on behalf of United States covert operations in different parts of the world. It's not a blowback to the era of the Cold War. Once you recognize that Al-Qaeda is a creature of U.S. foreign policy and of the U.S. Intelligence apparatus, your understanding and perceptions on 9/11 are totally different to what they might be in the case where you're, you know, an anti-war activist who wants to change the course of foreign policy, etc., etc. Because the lie ultimately behind this this camouflage and complicity is so grotesque. I'm not suggesting necessarily that the Bush administration ordered the destruction of the World Trade Center, but if the Bush administration is saying that Al-Qaeda is behind it, and that Al-Qaeda is a threat to America, while at the same time we have evidence that Al-Qaeda is collaborating with U.S. government agencies in covert operations in the Balkans, and that this happened, you know, barely a few months before 9/11, that we have evidence that that Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, its military intelligence, supports the terrorists and supports these terrorist organizations, and that's corroborated by the Council on Foreign Relations. If that is true on the one hand, and if on the other hand, that this same organization, Pakistan's ISI, has close bilateral relations with the CIA, with the State Department, I mean, I'm talking at the very, very senior levels, then there's something fundamentally fishier on these links. Go beneath the surface, you then realize that, in fact, Osama bin Laden is a creature of the U.S. Intelligence apparatus. His whereabouts are known. Al-Qaeda has collaborated with the U.S. military and intelligence and continues to collaborate. When you start looking into, let's say, the Bali bombing, and then you realize that the Bali bombing is conducted by a group which was trained in CIA camps in Afghanistan, that it has close links to Indonesian intelligence, and that Indonesian intelligence has close links to the CIA, well, then you say, well, there's something fishy there as well. These are things which people have to take cognizance of, because they are the tools of an anti-war movement. An anti-war movement is not simply one of expressing anti-war sentiment, of saying, I'm against the war. An anti-war movement is to disarm the main political and military actors behind the war agenda. It's to deconstruct them. It's to remove their legitimacy in the eyes of public opinion. Large segment of the anti-war movement actually supports the assumptions of the Bush administration regarding 9/11 to the fact that Al-Qaeda is a threat to the security of America, and that the war on terrorism is a valid objective of U.S. foreign policy. Of course, that weakens the anti-war movement, because you have a large segment of people who say, yes, I'm against the war, but I do support our administration in the war on terrorism, as if the two things were disconnected. And the issue is that the war on terrorism is the justification for conducting the war. Namely, 9/11 and the hoax behind 9/11 and the government camouflage and conspiracy behind 9/11 becomes the instrument for waging a war on the so-called sponsors of terrorism, the state sponsors of terrorism, which are the countries such as North Korea, Iraq, Iran, and so on.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
And then you have this propaganda campaign which attempts to link a relationship between, let's say, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. It's a failure to understand what is behind 9/11 as a conspiracy on the part of the U.S. government. In the 1980s, in the context of the Iran-Contra scandal, where Oliver North, of course, was indicted, along with Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, they were the visible personalities in the scandal, but the individual, the person within the U.S. military who actually played a very key role was Colin Powell, because Colin Powell signed the release forms for the transfer of weapons from logistics to Iran. And with the proceeds of those weapons sales, they funded the Mujahideen, the Islamic Brigades, as well as the Nicaraguan Contra. And we also know that Richard Armitage was behind that as well. So these individuals have, over the years, played a role in the process of support, of building and creating these Islamic brigades. And today, they say, Colin Powell in the United Nations Security Council will go in and say, we have to go after the terrorists. Saddam Hussein is linking up with Osama bin Laden, their buddy buddies, and so on. The fact of the matter is that after September 11, on September 13th, when the head of Pakistan's ISI, General Mahmoud Ahmad, was invited into the State Department to negotiate the terms of Pakistan's cooperation in the war on terrorism, he negotiated with Colin Powell and Richard Armitage. There were meetings held behind closed doors on the 12th and the 13th of September with the head of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence. Yet at the same time, the Bush administration knew, the FBI knew, the CIA knew, that this same individual was behind the transfer of money to the terrorists, as confirmed by an FBI report published in late September. They also knew of the historical link between the ISI and the terrorists. Obviously, they knew because they're behind it. The CIA is at the pinnacle of this relationship. CIA, ISI, Al-Qaeda. That understanding, I think, is crucial. In an anti-war movement, we have to understand that the main political actors are criminals. They are war criminals, but they're involved in a process of deceit using the instruments of intelligence, presenting the war on terrorism as an objective of U.S. foreign policy, when in fact they are the architects of these terrorist organizations. It's not simply going into the streets and saying, I'm against the war, please get out of Iraq. The way to organize an anti-war movement, the way you do that is to show that these people are criminals in the eyes of public opinion. And you reverse the consensus. The consensus is that the Bush administration is a legitimate government. It has made mistakes. It may have acted on the foreknowledge that something might have happened on 9/11, but there were failures and lapses and so on. That's the kind of consensus which is unfolding. I don't think that public opinion or even the anti-war movement is saying that this administration, these people should be arrested, okay? And they should be arrested in terms of their own legislation, their own laws that they are themselves enacting. If U.S. public opinion were to understand that the Bush administration is complicit, that the Bush administration was involved in acts of camouflage, the leaders behind this agenda would not have a leg to stand on. But we must not fall into the trap of revealing the links of a handful of individuals within the Republican Party or the Bush administration, when in fact the complicity is much broader. So the fact that successive administrations, Clinton, Bush, have supported Al-Qaeda, that this is on record, should constitute the basis for leading an anti-war movement, which will then discredit the leaders to the extent that meaningful changes can occur in the fabric of U.S. society, the fabric of the state apparatus, in the role of the corporations. An anti-war movement has to be coupled with an anti-globalization movement. We're not dealing with separate processes. We have to understand that dollarization, free trade as defined by the World Trade Organization, or under the free trade area of America's project, is part of this broader agenda of military conquest. As far as the FTAA is concerned, there's a concurrent and parallel military cooperation agreement between 28 countries of the hemisphere, which in a sense is being negotiated alongside the FTAA. It's important to understand the FTAA is part of the national security agenda. And Mr. Zelig, who is responsible as trade negotiator for the Bush administration, is himself a member of the national security team. The veto to the resolution of the United Nations suggests that the Bush administration is criminal, because they have upheld within the highest body of the United Nations the right of the Israeli authorities to kill Arafat. So they have endorsed within the UN framework the idea of political assassination, that if you don't like a political leader, you kill him. This decision of the United States in the United Nations Security Council to veto a resolution which condemns the assassination or the proposed assassination of Yasser Arafat ultimately grants legitimacy to Ariel Sharon. It's in fact the green light that he can go ahead and do it. Okay? He can go ahead and kill Arafat. The United States will support him. This diplomatic stance, because it's within the arena of the United Nations, is not very intelligent. Okay? Perhaps a democratic administration might have proceeded otherwise. Okay? In other words, they might say, well, let's get rid of Arafat, but we don't need to make it public. We don't need to plaster it on the tabloids that we're in favor of killing him. Okay? That is the nuance, maybe, between a Republican administration and a Democratic administration. This administration is not particularly good in international diplomacy. It states its agenda very clearly. It says, we don't like this guy, we'll go out and kill him. Okay? He's a threat to America, let's go and kill him. He's a threat to peace in the Middle East. Let's kill him and ensure continuity. Under Clinton administration, they would have said, yes, we support Shimon Arafat, and then they send in the CIA, and the CIA kills him off. What I'm trying to say is that this administration, on the surface, is looks really bad, because it advertises how bad it is to public opinion, and it makes the statement within the United Nations. But I don't think the choice is to have, if we go in for regime rotation in America and we get a new government, and the new government is not quite as explicit in terms of its plans to assassinate heads of state that they don't like or leaders that they don't like, well, that we've actually achieved something in the realm of progress or humanity.
The loyal opposition is, in fact, not an opposition, because the loyal opposition is committed ultimately to maintaining the status quo with regard to the American system of government and the American corporate agenda. It doesn't question the fact that Wall Street can take over health services and education. The main thrust of the U.S. economy is the weapons industry, that civilian activities are being destroyed with a view to beefing up the military-industrial complex, producing nuclear weapons, and so on and so forth. It doesn't ultimately get to the core of the American system of government and the American economic social system, or American capitalism, and I think that is the
I think that's the main weakness of this anti-war agenda. It doesn't disarm the system. It doesn't create the basis for disarming the system. It is also very much based on dramatic one-day public events, big rallies. So on a particular day, everybody goes to the streets, and it's a ritual in a sense. They go to the streets, and the objective of the organizers is to maximize the number of people who are out there. The objective is not necessarily to disarm the war agenda. Okay, and I think what we have to do is certainly continue with major public events, but build local level committees, which spread across America in neighborhoods, in parishes, in workplaces, that these will then constitute the basis of a genuine opposition, where alternatives are debated, where the war agenda is debated, where the legitimacy of the system is discussed, where information is transmitted. We have to weaken the propaganda apparatus. We have to have a system of alternative information which will inform our fellow citizens as to what is happening in the world, because when they read newspapers or when they look at television, they get a particular stylized version of events which never questions the legitimacy of the main political and military actors. It constitutes the basis for at least reversing the tide and disarming the war agenda.
That was Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa, Michelle Chisadovsky, heard via a documentary produced by Snowshoe Films. Roy and Karen Harvey of Snowshoe Films were at the conference and recorded an interview with another of the presenters, Jim Mars, who is the author of Rule by Secrecy and The Plot That Killed Kennedy. We'll conclude this week's program with that interview.
My name is Jim Mars, and I am a journalist, author from Texas. My background is in the newspaper as a newspaper reporter, and I've owned my own newspapers. I've also taught a course on the Kennedy assassination at the University of Texas at Arlington since 1976. And as a result, I became aware of not only the possibility, but the reality of high-level political conspiracies, if you will. I live in rural Texas, which is a pretty conservative and pretty much bush country, and they're strangely quiet about all this. I think they're very disquieted about what's going on, but they don't really know what to do about it. And I try to explain to them, this is why Gore could not be allowed to take the White House. This is why they had to get the Supreme Court to place George Bush in the White House. Because if Gore had gotten in, the very same things would have happened. We would have had 9/11, we would have invaded Afghanistan, we would have invaded Iraq, because that was part of the plan, okay? The difference would have been that as a perceived liberal Democrat, that right-wing, conservative, Republican bunch would have raised hell about his stripping of the Constitution and about his adventurism around the world. But with Bush in office, it kept him muted. And I've heard many of them say, I don't really quite agree with what's going on, but they can't bring themselves to get up and raise Cain about it because he's their guy, or at least that's the perception.
Is that something to do with his ability to manipulate the Christian groupings?
His widespread, again, I live in the Bible Belt, and his widespread support down there in the Bible Belt is just beyond me. It is the absolute apex of hypocrisy, because the very people who claim that he's such a great Christian man are allowing him to get away with the most unchristian things that I've ever seen. Everybody at this conference pretty much understands the facts that, yes, there was foreknowledge. Yes, we were not warned. It was not prevented. The standard operating and security measures were butchered that day. They were shredded, stripped away. All right. Airplanes that should have been in the air weren't in the air. The stringent security at airports was apparently not in effect. It's never been explained how all of these Arab hijackers managed to get on all these different airlines and hijack them at the same time and why there was no immediate response. It fit perfectly with plans that had begun to be formulated even in the previous Bush administration, which calls for an invasion of Afghanistan, for an invasion of Iraq, for a regime change, for gaining control over the oil in that region. All that was laid down. And Zygmunt Brzezinski, former Secretary of State to Jimmy Carter and head of the Secretive Trilateral Commission, wrote a book called The Great Game, in which he said that to accomplish all this would require another Pearl Harbor-type attack. Well, I think we saw that on 9/11. And so it's obvious that they were following a preordained game plan. Now, once that happened and once you understand that, you can see the tracks of foreknowledge. Everybody from the FBI to the CIA to the Russians, China, even the Taliban tried to warn us of what was going to happen. And the idea that they had no idea that they would seize airliners and fly them into buildings is simply a lie, because in the mid-90s in the Philippines, they busted an Al-Qaeda cell. They found the plans to Operation Pujinka, which call for hijacking airliners and flying them into prominent buildings, including the World Trade Center. Unless we forget, they had actually already bombed the World Trade Center in 1993, and in court was unrepentant and pledged that, well, we didn't do so well this time, but we'll do better next time. Anybody with half a brain, one eye, could have figured out that this is exactly what was going to happen. And I think the strongest case is that when you discover that people within Congress, that Attorney General John Ashcroft, that officials within the Pentagon, in August of 2001, just a week or two before the terrible events of 9/11, all said that they were not going to fly commercial airliners, they would only fly government chartered airplanes. Well, thanks a lot, fellas. Why didn't you tell the rest of us? The evidence of foreknowledge, the evidence of manipulation that's taken place in there, the reality versus the little happy stories that we were told. For example, the story they put out about finding Muhammad Atta's paper passport intact on a street in New York, when we're told that the black boxes that are designed to withstand air crashes didn't survive. I mean, how ridiculous can you be? And you know what? You talk about the left, the progressive. They've done the same thing with the Kennedy assassination. They tend to brush it off by saying, oh, well, he was a rich man's son, and we don't want to pay attention to that. Well, if you don't understand who was behind the Kennedy assassination, you're not going to be able to understand who was behind 9/11, because it's the same cast of characters and the same forces. And so 9/11, I think, obviously, since that is the underlying cause celebre of everything else that's going on, the Patriot Act, Homeland Security, the stripping of the Constitution, invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, and future invasions of Iran, Saudi Arabia, who knows what, all of that goes back to 9/11. And if 9/11 was not on the level, then none of the preceding events are going to be on the level. So I think you have to start with the initial impetus. I think the idea of peak oil, the idea that we're running out of oil, I think that's being used quite effectively on people of knowledge that this is the reason we need to do all this. I think it's even being used effectively on a subconscious basis with the American public, who, even if they don't think about it consciously, they kind of realize this is about oil, and I don't want to have to pay $3 and $4 a gallon, and I want to run my SUV. So it's like whatever happens over there is okay as long as it's not happening here in the U.S. But again, it's a false issue. What we should be doing is turning to alternative sources of energy. With just a little bit of tweaking to the carburetors in every modern car, we could be running on liquid hydrogen, which you can get by cracking water, you know, hydrogen and oxygen. And it's non-polluting, and it's plentiful. But then that's the problem. They can't get a monopoly over it. Actually, I had all this by mid-2002, had a contract with HarperCollins in New York, and was ready to publish a book called The War on Freedom that would outline everything that we've been talking about, plus give all the details, thoroughly sourced. It even passed the legal review, and then suddenly they just canceled it, but then paid me all the advance money. It was like, here, take your money and go away, because they did not want to publish this. And I've been trying to get this information out ever since then. And now I have revised it, I've updated it, and it is coming out. And if you'll give you some idea of what the major thesis is, the title will be Inside Job. I'll be publishing in conjunction with Origin Press here on the West Coast. Unfortunately, of course, you have your great unwashed masses who don't really think at all. They just believe whatever CNN or Fox News tells them. But among the people who are thinking, it's really kind of tragic to me how splintered they become and how distracted they become, because they're led off into Marxist, Trotskyist ideas or liberal ideas, or, you know, they push on social issues and they push on gender issues, they push on racial issues, and all in the world that does is keep us divided and conquered. What we need to do is all agree on certain basic fundamentals, like adhering to the Constitution and of the United States and the Bill of Rights. In other words, we all need to agree to disagree. And it's the same thing I've noticed here at this 9/11 conference. Instead of presenting a united front to the outside world and saying, look, this was an inside job, this is a sham, we need to rethink our whole idea about 9/11, who was really behind it, and therefore rethink what we're doing in response to it. Instead, they all end up fighting with each other over what, if anything, hit the Pentagon, what are the temperatures of the fires that burned the metal that caused the World Trade Center to collapse. And these are all valid issues, but they should be worked out behind closed doors and among people who have actually studied the details. They should be bringing in people who actually know what they're talking about, engineers, structural engineers, metallurgists, etc. What we should be presenting to the general population is a united front saying, listen, folks, we've been bamboozled, and we need to rethink this whole thing. Short of another major terrorist attack, which could stampede everyone into voting for Bush, what I see happening is that Kerry, who is a cousin to Bush, and another skull and bonesman, okay, and of the same stripe, would take office. If he takes office, everything will continue as it is. We will see some lessening of the domestic things to the point to where people say, oh, well, thank goodness we got rid of that terrible old Bush, and then they all go back to sleep. I think it's a total mistake not to focus on 9/11.
That was Jim Mars, author of Rule by Secrecy and the Plot That Killed Kennedy, speaking with Roy and Karen Harvey during the International Inquiry on 9/11 in San Francisco last March. Thanks to Mariah Gallardin of TUC Radio and Roy and Karen Harvey at Snowshoe Films for providing the recordings used in the program this week. You can find more of the wonderful productions of these two independent media makers at tucradio.org, tucradio.org, and snowshoefilms.com, snowshoefilms.com. The conference we've been playing is Phase 1 of the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11. Phase 2 will be held in Toronto, Canada, from May 25th through the 30th. That's just in a couple of weeks. For more information on that, on the web, go to www.911inquiry.org, 911inquiry.org. And to contact us on the program, visit our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
If you still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me, then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.